Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along on this wet and windy Sydney night to hear Michael Collins-Pearce make his inaugural appearance at the Sydney Institute. As I look around the room, I should also say thanks to Ian Brown, who's a good friend of Anne and myself, and a long-time member and supporter of the Sydney Institute, for making this possible tonight. So thanks for Ian. Thanks to Ian. Well, that's very nice. Ian's got one friend, which is a lot. I'm rather jealous, actually. I don't know where you get a friend from. I've no idea. As I look around the room, I note there are some of our regular supporters. There are some freeloaders who have come along tonight. There are some former members of the Sydney Institute who run financial and former Geelong grammar students, and quite a few who fit into all those categories. So you can always leave a donation on the way out if you want to come back. But now to something completely serious. Michael Collins-Pearce is known to many of you, but he was educated in Toowoomba Primary, at the King's School in Parramatta, at Balliol College in Oxford, and of course he's taught at Geelong Grammar, head of history in the archives, school curator, and of course he's really here today because he's an author and a biographer. And tonight our speaker's going to talk on the topic Geelong Grammar and its place in Australian history. Michael, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm honoured to have been invited to address the Sydney Institute on a subject close to my heart, Geelong Grammar School and its place in Australian history. Having served the school since November 1955 in an overlapping succession of roles, mainly as teacher of history and English, head of history, keeper of the archives, author of related articles and books, and now curator of the school, I have known it, warts and all, for 57 and a half years. And while I speak as an insider and cannot pretend to objectivity, the place of the school in the larger scheme of things has always intrigued and inspired me. Indeed, in only my second year on the staff, I wrote a pageant play, Their Succeeding Race, which was performed by vast numbers of boys in celebration of the school's first 100 years, and which attempted to weave together, largely in verse, three strands: the school's own history, that of Australia, and the divine purposes for humanity. I was only 25, and I suppose correspondingly bold. Seeing the school, if you like, as part of both Australia and the Kingdom of God, I still incidentally tend to see it thus, as a church school serving the world for ends both temporal and eternal. I think I knew what a Jesuit headmaster meant at a conference when everybody else was talking of education for life, when he said, "I believe in education for death." At Geelong Grammar, defined as an Anglican school, though open to all comers, the aim is a good Anglican blend, educating for both temporal and eternal life, a continual subconsciousness raised at times to consciousness of the dimensions beyond space and time, an awareness of the absolute importance and therefore the absolute equality of every boy and girl committed to our charge and of their parents and mentors. To Christians, this is equality in the only sense that ultimately matters, or indeed is practicable, equality as an object of God's love. And equally with Christians, to those who would not go so far or be so absolute in professing their aim, it is equality in the deserving of opportunities for fulfillment, both as individuals and as members of the community. To me, the school's highest purpose is in keeping the knowledge, or perhaps the rumour, of God alive. Geelong Grammar School had its small beginnings on or about the 1st of October 1855, when the colony of Victoria was 4 years old, and when 14 boys arrived at a building, now demolished, in Villamanta Street, Geelong, in response to an advertisement. Five Anglican clergymen were the original founders, among whom the senior figure was an old Harrovian and fellow of Trinity College, Cambridge, Charles Perry, the first Bishop of Melbourne, who had assumed that office in 1847 when the Diocese of Australia was divided into four dioceses, Sydney, Newcastle, Melbourne and Adelaide, and William Grant Broughton, founder of the King's School Parramatta, my own school as a boy, having hitherto signed his name as W.G. Australia, became merely W.G. Sydney. New South Wales was well into its seventh decade as a British colony. Victoria barely started on its third. From the United Kingdom, it all seemed very new, and perhaps still does. King's is now 182 years old, Geelong Grammar 157. And although Stowe, Bryanston, Gordonston, and a few other famous British schools are still in their first century, and a good many others, such as Marlborough, Wellington, and Clifton, in their second, Eton is in its sixth century, Winchester is in its seventh, Balliol, my own college at Oxford, this year celebrates its 750th anniversary, and the King's School Canterbury, in some sense progenitor of King's Parramatta, dates itself from the year 599, 2 years after the arrival from Rome of the small band of Benedictine monks led by St. Augustine of Canterbury at the Kingdom of Kent to reintroduce Roman Christianity to Britain at the behest of Pope Gregory I. Augustine is the subject of one of the stained glass windows in our Chapel of All Saints, a vivid reminder of that reintroduction, just as neighbouring windows depicting St. Patrick and Columba tell of the Celtic Christianity already there. I like the story of the Australian at Cambridge well into the 20th century, who was invited to tea by a good lady of the Victoria League. Having established where he came from, she said, "Ah, you must know my friend Mr. So-and-so. He is the parson out there." "No, madam," replied the undergraduate, "I'm sorry I don't. We have two parishes now, and I'm in the other one." The tiny school of 1855, starting in the parish of St. Paul's in Geelong, but soon moving to that of Christchurch, now has about 1,600 pupils, more than 100 times its original population of 14, and many of these are girls. There were little girls in the kindergartens earlier, but we first took big ones in 1972, though one arrived from Canada late in 1971. And in 1976 we became coeducational at all levels with the amalgamation of Geelong Grammar, the Hermitage and Clyde School. We have virtual parity of numbers between boys and girls in senior school now, years 10 to 12, after Timbertop, with 8 boarding houses of between 60 and 70, 4 for each gender, and 2 day boarding houses totalling 143 for both girls and boys, so-called day boarding because from Monday to Thursday their school day doesn't end until 8:30 at night. Timbertop Year 9 in the foothills of the Australian Alps near Mansfield has 126 boys and 102 girls, all of them boarders for that year. On 2 other sites are the preparatory branches of the school, the Turek campus, formerly Glamorgan, in Melbourne, embracing kindergarten to year 6, and Bostock House in Geelong, which has kindergarten to year 4. There are thus parallel years 5 and 6 at Corio and in Melbourne. It is all vastly bigger and more complex than 100 years ago, when the school was in its last year in Geelong, before the move in 1914, 7 miles out, to Corio, then a bare and often windswept plain. But it is still one school, with one principal, Mr. Stephen Meek, one vice principal, Mr. Charlie Scudamore, who doubles as head of Corio, and a head for each branch as well as for each house at Corio. The governing body is a council of about 14, sometimes called directors, since the school is a company in the legal sense. And they include at least one Anglican cleric and the president of the Old Longomerians, an important body formed in 1900 and now including several supporting clubs and 23 regional and overseas branches, the oldest of which is the United Kingdom branch, which has died annually since 1920. The Anglican Archbishop of Melbourne is the school's visitor. As well as our beautiful chapel of All Saints at Corio, the first half or more of which was the gift in 1914 of five old boys, the Faulkner brothers of Bunnook, the school has also a very beautiful but very different chapel of St. John the Baptist at Dimbadob, given by Miss Margaret McWay and built largely by the boys in 1958. More than 100 pupils hold scholarships of various kinds, including 19 for Indigenous students. One of these is given by the staff. And all the public funds we receive from government grants are devoted to scholarships. There are three chaplains, two at Corio, and since last October, the senior chaplain has been for the first time a woman priest, the Reverend Eleanor O'Donnell. Although Anglican in foundation and ethos, the school contains members of many other denominations, especially the Roman Catholic, and of several other faiths, Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, and so on. At Corio and Timbertop, all come together for the weekday and Sunday services, and those who choose to be readers, servers, or house chapel captains are often from other faiths. I think of the very first of several hundred Thai pupils to attend the school in 1947, Kasem Kasemsri, later his country's foreign minister, whose mother, a royal princess, said to the headmaster, James Darling, who was deeply moved by her words, "Kasem is a Buddhist, but I want him to experience the beauty of the Christian religion as well." The growth of the school's Asian connections can be seen as the fourth of seven major steps so far in its progress to what it is now, still in active and vibrant evolution. The first was the gradual predominance of borders, evident by the 1870s, and the simultaneous growth of a character that was unconventional among schools deriving from the English public or independent school tradition. This character reflected that of the second headmaster, John Bracebridge Wilson, who held that office for nearly 33 years, from the revival of the school in 1863 after a temporary closure. Wilson steadily established it on lines still evident today, until his death in 1895. He was the son of a Norfolk parson, who was himself a younger son in a peerage family, the Lords Berners, descended from King Edward III. And he and Canon Goodman, vicar of Christchurch for half a century, devised for the school a coat of arms, or more strictly a badge, whose shield bears in two of its quarters the royal lions or leopards, as in Wilson's own arms, and in its other quarters, the Southern Cross. Thus our badge, often miscalled a crest, symbolises at once the old world and the new. The Anglo-Australian character thus suggested is fairly persistent, although the school now contains boys and girls from every continent in the world, except Antarctica. Wilson was a layman, in itself unusual for a church school in the 19th century, and a marine biologist of distinction, a fellow of the Linnean Society. Religion to him was something better caught than taught. He would sometimes take boys in his yacht out into Port Phillip, collecting mollusca and algae, and over the bay to his property at Sorrento to work in his laboratory there. He raised the money and gave the land to build St. John's Church at Sorrento in 1873. He encouraged boys to roam and ramble in the Bellarine Peninsula, and a tradition developed of Saturday parties, expeditions from dawn to dusk, that survived the move to Corio, and from 1953 was channeled into Timbertop, with much longer hikes and a more formal study of the natural world. Like many others from gentle and noble families, Wilson had not been to school himself, but was privately tutored for entry to St. John's College, Cambridge. Thus, although he knew from contemporaries there a good deal about the recent reforms in the public schools emanating from Thomas Arnold at Rugby and others, he worked largely from first principles. Central to his school was concern for the individual boy. Each one had his own timetable, different from everyone else's. A wise and fatherly figure, he was the school's chief founder, albeit not an original one, except in the sense that he was well ahead of his time. Incidentally, but not unimportantly, he was one of five among the so far 11 heads of the school, now called principal, who have been sons of Anglican clergy, even though only two have been in holy orders themselves. One other is a son of a medical missionary. I'm reminded of the prevalence of clergymen as the avocation of the father of so many post-Reformation men and women who have attained distinction enough to warrant entry in the now 62 volumes of the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, ahead of doctors, soldiers, lawyers, and others. We owe much to the good upbringing, literacy, conversation, and care for others typical of rectory, vicarage, and manse at their best. 9 of the 11 have been English by birth, the exceptions being the one old Geelong grammarian among them, Lister Hannah, principal from 1994 to 1999, who is Australian, though born in Africa, and has headed 6 schools in 6 countries, and John Lewis, a New Zealander, who after 14 years at Geelong Grammar returned to Eton in 1994 as its headmaster for the next 8 years. It is not, of course, the policy of the school to appoint Englishmen, or indeed men. Rather, the person best fitted to the needs of the time in the judgment of the council. Not the least of Geelong Grammar's services to Australia and farther afield has been the provision of educational leaders. More than 100 of its staff have gone on to head secondary schools or university colleges in 5 continents. A good local pair of examples is Jeremy Maiden and Nick Sampson at Cranbrook. The second big step in the school's progress was the move to Corio in 1914, made possible by the generosity of benefactors typical of the school community throughout its history. A corollary was the near trebling of its boy population to about 350 by the time in 1930 that the second very long and also very influential headmastership began, when the 30-year-old James Darling succeeded the Reverend Dr. Francis Brown, who had, with grave, somewhat austere dignity and meticulous attention to every detail, seen the school through its move after succeeding Leonard Lyndon in 1912, and through its first 16 years at Corio. As to him, Dr. Brown, its most priestly head, so to all the others, from the very Reverend George Vance on, the school owes a great debt of gratitude to 11 individuals, very different in almost all except their dedication to the school, and not a dud among them. The moving and expansion of the school were a result of fresh blood on the council from 1908, when the first Old Boys became members, led by William Manifold and Donald McKinnon, both of them graziers of generous ideals and pockets and deep humanity. Many Geelong grammarians had already gone on to Oxford and Cambridge, where the school's early fame was as a nursery of oarsmen, especially Steve Fairbairn, and they knew something of what the best English schools were like. Inspiring them was the influence of Wilson and his great assistant from 1875, James Lister Cuthbertson, poet and aspiring teacher of the classics, who had also fostered rowing and other sports. Athleticism in the public schools was at its height in the Edwardian era, and Geelong Grammar was not free from it, although it has been only on the river that the school has been consistently strong over a century and more. The last time it claimed a football premiership was in 1902. The girls have notably contributed to the rowing since the 1980s. The school has helped to produce many Olympians, as many as 9 in the 1956 Games, led by John Landy, then back at the school on its staff. In the early decades, many sons of graziers and farmers, particularly in Victoria's Western District, attended the school, and many of these became pioneer settlers in other Australian colonies, especially Queensland and Western Australia. More than 150 boys came from Western Australia before 1930, usually by sea. By the 1880s, it was beginning to be an all-Australian school, and so it remained to add an international outreach in the second half of the 20th century. In 1882, Wilson said on speech day that there were boys in the school from every one of the 6 colonies and also New Zealand. We have, he said, a beginning of federation in the school, an ideal not achieved in the nation for nearly 20 more years. The contribution to the pastoral industry of families with names such as Armitage, Austin, Beggs, Black, Bostock, Calvert, Chernside, Chumley, Fairbairn, Faulkner, Henty, Hopkins, McCartney, Manifold, Ritchie, Russell, Staunton, Whittingham, and many more has been immense, and the school's part in it a great one. More than 50 descendants of Manifold pioneers, over 70 of Mary and Frances Chumley, over 100 of John and Elizabeth Austin, and more than 150 of George and Elizabeth Armitage have attended Geelong Grammar, names present in almost every generation of its members since at least the 1870s. At least 2 families, the Pincotts and the Cummings, have now achieved a 6th-generation connection with the school. The third great step was the adding in the 1930s, under the inspiration of Darling, of art, craft, music and drama to the essential offering, all of them brought in from the peripheries of the curriculum to occupy a central role and contribute richly to what Weston Bate, in his 1990 history of the school, Light Blue Down Under, called A Little Athens. The art school was built in 1937. The music school, one of many gifts from the Bell and Biddlecombe family, in 1938. Each a pioneer in Australia. Sparta perhaps dominated Athens through the war years, and necessarily so, but not completely. It was in 1942 that Darling rescued the great Ludwig Hirschfeld Mack, an early member of the Weimar Bauhaus, and in 1940 a Danira boy from an internment camp, to be for nearly 16 years a joy and inspiration to our aspiring artists. It was humbling, said Darling, to realise during the war that the most Christian soul among us was a German. James Fairfax, Daniel Thomas, Rupert Murdoch were among his pupils. Rupert achieving early fulfilment in the editing of a wonderful literary and artistic journal, If Revived, which was the post-war successor to If, in which the early poetry of John Manifold and Michael Thwaites was published. It was during the war years, too, that the young man in Clark coached cricket and inspired many of the brighter boys, such as Jamie Mackey and Tim Burstall. Darling believed in a variety of talents and outlooks on the staff, and had himself been of a Christian socialist bent in his salad days, inevitably tempered by the demands of the headmastership. The strong literary tradition in the school had taken a largely leftwards turn in the 1930s through the writings of such boys as John Manifold and Geoffrey Dutton, Michael Thwaites, Rhodes Scholar, Newdigate Prize winner at Oxford, King's Medalist for Poetry in 1939, was an exception. Although in politics, only Richard Marles in our own time has represented the Labour Party in the federal parliament, where more than 20 Geelong Grammarians of more conservative views have served, though some of them, such as Sir John Gorton, like, say, Sir Rupert Hamer as Premier of Victoria, have been distinctly small L in their liberalism. Other notable federal ministers have included the great Charles Hawker and James Fairbairn, both tragically killed in air accidents at the age of 43, and Sir Alexander Downer, Sir David Fairbairn, and Alexander Downer the Younger, not to mention many in colonial and state parliaments, and some in those of other countries. There was a time recently when the foreign ministers of Australia, Malaysia and Thailand were all old Geelong Grammarians. The remaining great steps can be mentioned briefly. The fourth, the growing Asian connection, was far-sighted in its early years. Mainly Thai in the 1950s, when Misha Vidavija, senator and promoter of contraception, and Prince Shatri Yukol, a famous film director, were at the school, mainly Malaysian in the 1960s. In both these countries, ultra-longomerians have held highly responsible positions, headships of Thai government departments, in Malaysia the throne, and since then embracing many nations, including South Korea, Japan, China, Indonesia and Nepal. The school's contribution to Papua New Guinea has been considerable through support of the Martyrs Memorial School and through the leadership of Professor Glenn Liddell Mola in surgery and the training of surgeons. The fifth step, taken in 1953, was the foundation of Timbertop, the original pioneer in its field and still almost unique in the range and extent of its program towards connecting the youth with the natural world. To its founder, Sir James Darling, it was primarily a place for spiritual development. Because when Prince Charles was entrusted to us for most of 1966, he was placed by the headmaster, Tommy Garnett, basically at Timbertop, though he was also at Corio from time to time. That branch of the school attained worldwide fame. The Prince of Wales's book Harmony expresses beautifully the ideals that animate the school as a whole, and Timbertop in particular. Like our art and music schools, Timbertop has inspired not only many individuals, but also many other schools towards a richer education in the joy and fullness of living. The sixth step was co-education, towards which, among schools of our kind, independent and boarding, Geelong Grammar was the first in Australia to change. 3 years after Marlborough in England, which began to take girls in 1968. Tommy Garnett prepared the way for it while head at Marlborough and implemented it at Geelong Grammar. His successor, the Honourable Charles Fisher, then in his too short time with us before his death in a car accident, led the way into full co-education. Many Australian schools, especially in Victoria, have followed, I believe to their benefit and that of the great majority of their pupils. The seventh and latest step has been the introduction since 2008 of what is called positive education. Not in essence a radical innovation, rather a sharpening of focus, an encouragement to build on existing strengths rather than agonise over weaknesses, a fostering of resilience in the face of difficulty and incipient despair. It is leading, I believe, and all the evidence points that way, a book is being prepared on the subject, towards a greater vibrancy, an access of simple happiness. Though Geelong Grammar has always, in my experience, been a comparatively happy community, by and large a gentle, tolerant and civilising one, by contrast with the more macho norms. Of course we've had from time to time our bullies, boys of a thuggish kind, girls who subtly exclude and humiliate those who think and behave in uncool ways, but they have not been the norm. And increasingly, I believe, the culture of the school both discourages such tendencies and fosters a spirit of forgiveness when they appear, the bullies, of course, needing understanding and help no less than their victims. Corio and Timbertop being on country sites, we've been comparatively free from the problems caused by drugs in many city schools. The school's place, then, in Australian history is not easy to define briefly, since it is in many ways and a fairly exotic bloom in the Australian landscape, and liable to be stereotyped as privileged, elitist, and with other clichés, by some who, without really knowing the school, are hostile to it. I've suggested ways in which it's been a beacon, educationally. In general, however, its place derives from the respect and often love created by the characters and contributions of those who've been educated there. That is to say, drawn out towards the fullness of being. There are many among them who have achieved distinction. Peter Carey in literature, for instance, or John Landy and Craig Mottram in athletics, General Sir John Hackett as both soldier and author, Alistair Crombie, historian and philosopher of science, and several others who, as fellows of Oxford or Cambridge colleges, have advanced learning. They include Lord Browers, first full-time Vice-Chancellor of Cambridge in the field of electronics, several fellows of the Royal Society, an exceptional number of diplomats, including Peter Henderson and Richard Woolcott, both secretaries of the Department of Foreign Affairs, and Sir David Hay, Administrator of New Guinea, Secretary of Aboriginal Affairs, Sir Russell Drysdale as a painter, James Fairfax and David Roche as patrons of art, Sir Brian Ingalls and Sir Rod Carnegie and Hugh Morgan as leaders of industry, Sir John Young as a great Chief Justice, Phoebe Fraser, now Winpope through Care Australia, Missy Higgins through her songs, Geoffrey McFadden in medical research, and so on. A book by ultra-longomerians on 100 of them is in preparation. But the same is true of Scotch College, Melbourne Grammar, Sydney Grammar, Cranbrook, King's, Askham, Frensham, Churchy, St. Peter's, and other great Australian schools. What perhaps constitutes the special contribution of Shilongramarians has been the faithful, lifelong, and characteristically unsung service of their communities, including many rural ones. A continuation in democratic Australia of a long tradition defined recently by Adam Nicholson in his book Gentry, about families through 600 years of English history who've exemplified the characteristics and qualities of those embraced by that word. Perhaps Geelong Grammar's rather special place in Australian history derives mainly from the transmission and fostering through ever-changing circumstances of such a tradition, tolerant, idiosyncratic, with wide interests, as Sir James Darling said of Charles Hawker, able to converse equally of sheep and Keats, and contributors to their communities. Darling in particular fostered a sense of public duty. I used to hear people say, you can tell a Geelongramarian by his manners, meaning, I think, good ones. I believe it is still essentially true. If by manners is meant not so much an outward show of care and consideration, that usually follows, as the simplicity and straightforwardness of address, the inner disposition of friendliness, concern, and potential love, which treats others with respect and sees all whom it encounters as potential brothers or sisters. If I am right, the school's place in Australian history is not so much one of power as of influence, like that of a stream which, flowing both above and beneath the ground, brings life and health to the land through which it flows.
Well, many thanks to Michael. For a fine presentation. So we come to questions and discussion. We've got till 7 o'clock, so we've got plenty of time. We're trying to pick everything up on our podcast here, so if I think you can't be heard on the podcast, I'll briefly repeat bits of the question, but if you can speak out loudly, that's fine. So if you come back here, Michael, and talk to the end of the room, and I'll just lead off. It was a very wide group of names that you mentioned there, but you didn't mention Kerry Packer, I think.
Was it deliberate?
No, one of the famous people you did mention told me that when a student at Geelong Grammar, Kerry Packer spent more time with Matron than would have been regarded as necessary for purely medicinal reasons. Were there any such scandals? But secondly, I mean, if you read some of the material on Kerry Packer, you get the impression that he was kind of dumped in grammar by his parents in Sydney. Were there such examples in the boarding school, or was that unfair of Mr. Packer? Have I been unfair to the late Mr. Packer, who I quite liked, actually?
I taught Kerry in my first full year, 1956. I had him for 18th century history, and I felt very proud of him when, 32 years later, there was the possibility of the publication at last of the great Banks Florilegium, the wonderful illustrations that Solander and Parkinson had derived from Cook's great voyage that languished for two centuries. There was the possibility of their publication at $250,000 per set, and perhaps 25 sets or 50. And Kerry, when asked whether he'd like to buy one and told that it was in jeopardy, said, well, if it'll make any difference, I'll buy the lot. he had to buy only two, I gather, but I felt proud of my student of 18th century history. Whether there was any connection, of course, one simply can't know. But I remember him. I used to play tennis with him, and I liked him very much. He did spend quite a lot of time with Jane Stoddard, who was the very remarkable, wonderful matron of Perry House for 32 years. And she was, I think, the nearest that he had to a mother who really cared for him, as I think to his housemaster in Perry, Vic Tunbridge, was the nearest to a father. It is true, probably, that his parents had slightly dumped, as you say, him. And I'm sure quite a lot of children have been. But that's all right from the school's point of view. We then get on with the business of nurturing and educating them as best we can. But I didn't leave Kerry out deliberately. And of course, he made a huge contribution in various fields.
Okay, so who's next? Ellen.
You mentioned the headmastership of Tommy Garnett. I was at Charterhouse in the 1950s when he was a master there, and he also looked after the school farm as a sideline. And of course, he was then noted for all sorts of eccentricities. So when I came to this gorgeous country, he invited my wife and myself for afternoon tea, and I told him that he was remembered most by the younger boys for his little interesting habits. And he said, name one. And I said, yes, you had a lavatory chain as the doorbell, one of those long old and the younger kids would, of course, pull the thing and pop it quick. And he said, oh, it's a good job you didn't hear about the day my pigs got into chapel.
Yes, what you've told me about Tommy, thank you so much, rings absolutely true. He began his first master's meeting in September.
So we're dealing here with Tommy who?
Tommy Garnett, who was headmaster from 1961 to 1973, after being head of Marlborough. And he played a large role in bringing in co-education at both schools in England and Australia. His first master's meeting began with his saying, the only masters I remember from my school days are the mad ones. We must have more madness. I remember thinking, you don't know yet how much you've already got. And there was a bit of a tension, a bit of a tussle for three or four years between most of the staff and the new headmaster. But it worked out well, and the last years of the Garnett era were a very golden one. And he went on, of course, to be one of Australia's great gardeners and probably the best writer on nature that Australia has yet had. He was a very remarkable man. His biography has been written by an old boy, Andrew Lemon.
So, right, so there's a question here.
Is it true that the Austin family introduced the rabbit to Australia?
But is Geelong Grammar responsible for rabbits?
They began to come to the school actually a couple of years after the introduction of the rabbits, which was in 1867, to provide sport for the Duke of Edinburgh. Thomas Austin at Barwon Park introduced the rabbits, and James Austin, his brother, at Avalon, just across the lagoon from the school, introduced the hares. I think there were a few rabbits in Australia before that, but they hadn't got away.
Ian.
Michael, over here. I'd like you to reflect a little bit more on some of the more colourful personalities. I've been privileged to attend your 70th birthday, your 80th birthday, and we're both spared. I hope to attend your 90th.
Thank you.
If you'll have me. And I remember at your 70th, you're entertaining us royally by talking about, I think, the senior year in 1956.
Oh, the extraordinary...
Two of your distinguished students distinguished themselves by one becoming a serial cat burglar and another one becoming the president of the Vegetable Burial Society.
Well, you've chosen my reply. You've stolen my... No, that's all right. It's true. It's just that it was actually the fifth form British history. class. We were studying 19th and 20th century British history. And it was the most wonderful and eclectic collection of individuals. I was learning my way, feeling my way at the school. And there was Hugh Morgan, who went on to be a captain of industry, head of Western Mining and lots of other things. There was Bruce Capfer, who from Sydney, who went on to be one of Australia's great anthropologists, I think in Scandinavia mainly. There was, I won't name him, yes, the future cat burglar, who 13 years later brought his newly married wife to meet me and said, "You're the only one who was nice to me at school." But at least he came back. And then shortly afterwards, perhaps under the influence of the wife, he gave himself up to the police and did his time. He was a bit Robin Hoodish. He concentrated on tax evaders. But whether he went the whole way and gave it all back to the poor, I'm not so sure. But he gave himself up after he'd committed, I gather, 1,000 successful robberies. So he did well. And there too was Geoffrey Dye, who perhaps appropriately named because he was the founder of the Vertical Burial Society. He was worried that we were running out of space.
There's a question here, and then we'll come here. Yeah.
You mentioned the years of closure. When Wilson was appointed, was the school functioning? And if, either way, was there continuity of the board through that period of closure?
There was a continuity of both kinds in a way. Wilson had been third and then second master in the early days. And during the closure from middle of 1860 to the end of 1862, he kept teaching a lot of the boys. And the board remained in existence. And there was an attempt to found a joint Anglican-Presbyterian school. And that was beaten by the High Anglicans, led by Sir Charles Sladen, a great friend of Wilson's, later Premier of Victoria, who felt that it was compromising the principle of episcopacy. And so the Presbyterians went it alone and founded Geelong College, Geelong Scotch College, as it was called at first, in 1861, under George Morrison, whose brother Alexander Morrison was principal of Scotch College in Melbourne. So there was continuity of a sort, and you can treat it either way. Anyway, we date ourselves from 1855 rather than 1863.
I have a question here.
Having met you many years ago with your brother at Budrum at your parents' place,
Yes. Was
your origin in the bush?
Yes.
It was. Would you just discuss that? Did you read lots of books? What sort of education did you have there?
I had a wonderful governess. I had a wonderful nurse. Well, wonderful parents, but also a wonderful nurse who was Presbyterian, Anglican parents, and then a Roman Catholic governess who was at least as wonderful as all of them, and certainly I did read. I taught myself to read because I loved having books read to me, and I adored Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, and I knew it by heart, and so I got hold of the actual book and applied what I knew to the symbols on the page, and when they came to teach me to read, they were a bit surprised that I could already do it. But I didn't do much formal school. Queensland Correspondence School sent papers up every mail day. We were about 70 miles out of Brisbane, not terribly far, but it was very much bush, and a lot of the time, of course, we were in the saddle. We were mustering cattle, and it was a very happy childhood, a very fortunate childhood, and then boarding school from the age of 9, and I've never really known anything else. I'm in my 200th term at Geelong Grammar now. You might say a very slow learner.
Rafe.
On the topic of the success and achievements of the sons of Anglican clergymen, apparently, I think before the war, a group of Rhodes scholars were chatting in the quadrangle, five or six of them. They found they were all the sons of Anglican clergymen.
That's fascinating. And I'm not totally surprised. I mean, it's a very impressive example, though, of what I was saying.
And?
The whole ethos of teaching can be so wonderful and marvellous, and yet we've got a period of time now where there's a great deal of angst about the teaching profession, the sort of graduates that are going into it, and it isn't really about necessarily money. Money plays a part. What advice would you give to the governors of the country as to what might be the sort of way in which the ethos of teaching can be brought back into focus?
Well, to reassure them fairly constantly that they're the important ones, that buildings are important and facilities and computers and so on, but it's people, really, and that it's a noble profession. And the same can be said of politicians. Alexander Downer, the younger, came and spoke at our speech day about 5 years ago, and it was a time when politicians were getting a huge amount of flack, as indeed they are at the moment. And he spoke particularly to our Year 12 boys and girls and said, don't believe what you read or hear. It is a noble profession and you must go in with high ideals and stick to them and do your best. I'd say all that, but of course they should be adequately repaid. And the long gone are the days when I heard Darling once say, if anyone asked me what his salary was going to be, I'd never appointed him. couldn't get away with that now.
Tell us a bit about, you mentioned the socialist influence at the school. I mean, I think there was a time there in the 1950s where half the members of the Communist Party were alienated former Catholic altar boys and the other half were graduates of Geelong Grammar. You've mentioned John Manifold. I think Ian Turner went to Geelong Grammar.
No.
He didn't.
No.
Manifold did. I mean, yes. Was there a significant left-wing influence in the school?
Well, I think the school has been pretty good on the whole at teaching people to think for themselves. That's probably the best fruit in many ways of a good education, to be an independent thinker. And quite a lot, especially in the 30s and early 40s, and Manning Clark, as I said, was responsible for an influence in the from 1940 on to 44. They did go to the left, and it was a time when it was happening in many independent or public schools. Darling had been a boy at Repton from 1913 to 1917, when he went off to serve in the war. His two headmasters were both future Archbishops of Canterbury, William Temple and Geoffrey Fisher. William Temple was one of the founders, really, of the tradition of Christian socialism. And the prime influence on Darling probably was Victor Gollancz, who founded the Left Book Club later. And he was a very brilliant man and a tremendously inspiring teacher who lit a flame that never really was extinguished in, I think, probably any of his pupils. Yes, I think, I wouldn't say half the members of the Communist Party, but certainly one or two of them. Stephen Murray Smith, I think, joined it for a while.
Yeah. Okay, there's a question here. Yep.
After your wonderful recap of the history and dynamics over the last 50-plus years of your time at Geelong Grammar, I'd be interested to know, how do you see Geelong Grammar developing over the next coming 50 years?
It's always very risky for a... especially for an historian to predict. I finished my own history of the school in 1995 in which quite a prominent hope was expressed, because the school at that time was contemplating, it had gone halfway at least towards establishing a branch in Thailand. But then in 1997 the Thai economy collapsed and the Thais withdrew all their support and returned very faithfully all the money the school had put in. So that didn't come to pass. Some English schools, of course, have achieved that, particularly Harrow. I see it, I think, as being still primarily an Australian school, but with that tradition deriving from the English public schools of good learning and friendliness, and all the things I mentioned, the sport, the art, the drama, and so on. We're about to build a huge centre for creative endeavour, and we will at last, I think, have a place where the whole school can gather together, which will be nice. I think and hope, and barring some awful disaster, that people will still tend to come to us from all around the world. Young people seem to be Googling us in places like Poland and South Korea, and they turn up sometimes. There was even a boy from Melbourne Grammar a few years ago who was about 13, and he rang up the admissions department and said, "Will you take me?" the registrar, and a very nice woman, gulped and said, "Well, probably, but it is usual to have some contact with parents." So that followed, and he came, and a brother and a sister followed, and it was all wonderful. But the young are increasingly independent in that sort of way. So all I can do is hope. I don't know whether that's really an answer to your question, but I can't predict the eighth major step unless perhaps it's a bit towards adding beyond year 12, and we used to have a year 13 and even 14 for a few boys, the upper sixth form, particularly those who were aiming at Oxford or Cambridge. Possibly there'll be more university-style studies. And I hope that there'll be more of a reaction than there is at the moment against the narrowing of courses. The tendency at the moment is to go very deep into certain topics, but to study, for instance, the French Revolution, but not really know much about what was going on in Germany or Italy or Spain or Russia at the same time.
These days we're all very concerned about misogyny, so please explain Sam Newman. Where did... What was he like?
Sam was a charming boy, rather naughty. I didn't teach him, but I knew him, and he grew up in the school because his father was on staff. His father was an ultra-long man too, and he taught at the school for 36 years and was a considerable character on the staff. And Johnny, I think of him as Johnny because he's John, not Sam, really. Sam's his nickname. Was a friendly boy. He's still a good friend. He's got a boy at the school at the moment, and I'm not quite sure which of his wives is the mother, but... But that's my fault. That's my
fault. If I missed anyone, we're coming to the end.
Has the board over the years shown an obvious policy and a procedure for maintaining standards and the traditions of the school?
Yes, I think you'd have to say yes. They'd be worried if. And there have been times when concern was shown, but of course they depute the running of the school to the principal, as he's now called, or she will now be called when there's a woman in the office, as undoubtedly there will be sometime. Geelong College has had one woman already as principal. I think one of the important things about the school, and I didn't really say it, is that the old Geelong Grammarians are tremendously supportive, but they don't throw their weight about. I've known one or two schools, including, if I dare say it, my own old school, King's, where the old boys' union is very powerful. And at Melbourne Grammar, for instance, the decision was made by the council to go co-educational sometime in the 1980s, and they were held down by the whole school community. And they had to rescind the decision a few months later. Nothing like that has happened, except in the late 1920s, there was an attempt to change the name of the school. Some, I think for snobbish, for bad reasons, felt that grammar was the word grammar was doing us some harm, especially in England, where grammar school meant government or state school. And so the council did actually pass a resolution to change the name of the school as it's moved from Geelong to Corio, to Corio College, but they were beaten, and that's the one time when the old boys of the school at that time did assert themselves. Not perhaps a full answer, but they're very conscious, and there are always a number of highly aware and sensitive old Geelong men on the council. It's not dominated by them, but all the chairmen of council, except one, have been old Geelong Grammarians, and They say, and they usually have their own children going through the school or recently through the school, and so they do care about the state of things.
And finally, what about the relationship between Geelong Grammar and Geelong College and the Anglican school, the Presbyterian school originally? Was there tension between the two schools, between the students of the schools in sport, on the sporting field or elsewhere?
Well, they're always fiercely fought matches, and yet when we're both trailing the field, as we tend to do in athletics, vying for 10th place, we very much support each other. We're small schools compared with some of the Melbourne ones. I mean, they're up in the 3,000 and 4,000, some of them, and we're less than 1,000 boys, for instance, competing in them. It's a wonder, really, that we don't come 10th in everything.
Many thanks.
Can I take a close look?
It's never happened before. Our speaker wants to take a photograph, so just look like you're all listening very intently. And down there.
I nearly took it before, just when you were all looking very expectant.
Should have done that.
Just in case you look depressed and disappointed. Sorry, it takes a little while to warm up, but I still use film. I won't promise to send a print to everyone, but if anyone special wants.
It must be like classroom. Was it like this in class? Was it?
A little bit.
Yeah, I thought so.
I think you'd better be in this one.
Not me.
Mind?
Well, I'll sit down here.
You look very thoughtful.
Thank you all very much.
I suppose we all note from the acclamation that Michael Collins' Hearst has done terrifically well tonight. It was an important talk and a lively question discussion period. I learnt a lot. I learnt about Kerry Packer and the Matron, or some of it. I learnt that Geelong Grammar produced the gentler, kinder cat burglar, which I think is pretty important. But I learned a lot about what was obviously been and remains a very important educational institution within Australian society, and some of the names you mentioned were men and now women were quite fascinating. So well done for tonight. The speech will be on our podcast tomorrow. Anne will publish the paper in the Sydney Papers online soon in the order in which they come, and we'd love to have you back again. But for tonight, well done and thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.